Welcome to Excess Returns, where we focus on what works over the long term in the markets. Join us as we talk about the strategies and tactics that can help you become a better long-term investor.
Justin Carbonell and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.
Hey guys, this is Justin. In this episode, Jack and I sit down with Adam Butler of Resolve Asset Management to talk about AI, large language models, ChatGPT, and more. From how the technology works to the implications for business and investors, and how this powerful tech may impact asset managers and the overall market. Adam has spent considerable time using ChatGPT and building bots, so we couldn't have thought of a better person to join us for this discussion. As always, thank you for listening. Please enjoy this discussion with Resolve's Adam Butler. Adam, thank you very much for coming back and joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on, guys. I'm really excited about this conversation. I've actually spent basically all my free time. My kids call and my wife call ChatGPT Chatterica because they feel like I'm having an affair with her. I spend all my time in the evenings and on the weekends programming with her, building tools with her, and I even now refer to her, as is clear from our conversation so far. So yeah, very passionate and excited for this chat.
And you know, that's why we wanted to invite you back on, because you know, by following your you know, you on Twitter and just knowing how much time you've spent looking at ChatGPT, thinking about AI, thinking about how it's going to affect the investment management business, and I think a lot, pretty much every business probably will be in some way, shape or form affected by this kind of crazy technology. So yeah, this is going to be great. So maybe just to start, and I know, you know, you're not like deep in the weeds coding this kind of stuff, although you're using it a lot. Just if you were to explain, you know, what a large language model is, LLM model is, to, you know, your normal investor sort of on off the street, how would you describe that?
It's a machine that has ingested trillions and trillions of words and other data sources from the internet and other publicly available data repositories. And underneath, it is a model that's finding relationships between different words and different combinations of words. And when you go in and interact with it to sort of chat with it, you give it a series of words. And it then goes back into the model and finds relationships between the words that you have just sent it and all of the other words and combinations of words and documents that it has in its kind of data repository. And then it begins to add more words that relate best to the words that you have just sent to it. And then each time it generates a new word or a new combination of words, it then goes back and, you know, rechecks with the model, adding on those new words to then add the next word. And then it goes back with all of the words that you added plus the words that it's written and goes back again and resources it. And then continues on in this sort of recursive way to, you know, answer your question or address the query, right? So at root, it's just sort of predicting the next word. And they don't use the word word, they use the word token. A token is kind of like a section of a word, but we could kind of think about it as a word and think about what's going on under the hood as it's predicting the next word, constantly referring to all of the other words that have been either given to it or produced by it over the course of answering the question, right? And it sounds trivial. It's just predicting the next token or predicting the next word. But it turns out that when you've got a repository that consists of basically the entire knowledge base of the internet, plus a wide variety of other knowledge bases that maybe are not directly accessible or easily accessible for most people over the internet, that the level of relationships that are, connected, interconnected within the model allows it to express what can only be described as reasoning or creative modes that would otherwise be completely unexpected to get from a machine. And in that way, it is completely unlike any other machine that humans have created in the past. You know, I've heard lots of pundits refer to this technology as kind of like just a natural evolution in the arc of human development, you know, kind of akin to the printing press or the microchip or what have you. But, you know, to me, this is a completely different class of technology, because now you have technology that can make its own decisions and act on the world based on those decisions in an almost infinite variety of ways, depending on the tools that you expose to it and you allow it to use in order to exert its decisions on the world. So, I mean, you know, the printing press allowed you to build, print a million copies of a book that a human created, but it didn't allow you to write a million new, completely novel books, right? And I think that's the level of difference that people are very slowly coming to grips with.
One of the things that I find interesting, and maybe it's always been happening within ChatGPT, but I feel like it's kind of maybe newer with ChatGPT-4, is that there seems to be like some type of like, and I can't think of the exact example, but like it's giving me disclaimers, or it's giving, it knows if it gives a response to a prompt, if there's some risk associated with that, and that might not be the right word, but there's something that, you know, you should be aware of. It's almost like the technology knows that, hey, there could be a decision here that could be bad for who's ever prompting it. And let me explain sort of what the risks are, or what the, I guess, downsides are, something like that. I've noticed that more in some of the responses with some of the stuff I'm asking, which is interesting, I think.
Yeah, that's so the models are created by training on trillions of words from all these different data sources, as we've discussed. But there's a second stage called reinforcement learning with human feedback, where, you know, thousands of people are given the model to interact with, and then they rate the responses. And depending on how they rate the responses, the machine then, or the model then, learns the kinds of responses that are preferred by humans. And then there's other type of alignment that is done at the model level, where the people that develop the model give it guidance. For example, they constrain it and say, you know, you're not allowed to give explicit medical advice or advice. You're not allowed to give explicit legal advice. You're not allowed to give explicit investment advice. And so what you'll notice is, if you ask it a medical question, sometimes it will give you an answer depending on how much risk there is, in terms of, like, if you ask a very personal question, should I go see a doctor? It won't give you advice. Or should I be concerned? It might give you some guidance, but then it'll say, you know, I understand your question, or you're concerned about this. This is related to this, but you should go see a doctor to get an expert opinion. Or, you know, if you ask a similar thing about a legal subject, it might give you a general answer, but then it'll say you should seek advice from a lawyer, right? All of this is built into either constraints on the actual model itself. So they actually change the model weights. So they give different weights to the kinds of responses that will emerge naturally from the model. And then there's a system prompt that is injected. So, you know, you type in a question into ChatGPT. Well, before your question, there's a system prompt that is injected that says stuff like, you know, never give out dangerous advice, never give out medical advice without describing risks, never give. So there's all of these guidelines that exist both at the model level and at this system prompt level that, you know, so OpenAI, for example, is doing their best to make sure that the model is not used for or used in ways that it's not really designed to be used for. It's not, you know, it's not specially trained on medical data. And the vast majority of medical data is behind private firewalls and is not accessible to it for training, right? It turns out, in fact, that with the right prompting, GPT-4 on its own gets like in the 90th percentile on a battery of medical professional exams. So it does remarkably well, given that it's only trained on a very small fraction of the total available medical knowledge base, but it's not really been tested as a physician who's, you know, is going to give clinical guidance to patients. And so the model developers have put constraints on it so that it's not able to do that. And until we're able to thoroughly test its capacities, then that's probably the responsible thing to do.
Yeah, I just saw this the other day because my dad wants to update his will. And so I figured like I'll come up with this huge prompt about exactly what he wants in his will and all the information it needs. And what I got back is, you know, a huge disclaimer with, you know, here are the types of things that should be in a will, but then a big legal disclaimer about like we can't provide legal advice. So yeah, I saw that myself yesterday.
You know what's funny? I did exactly the same thing for my brother back in April or May. And it completely rewrote the will, no problem, right? So over time, they have added these different constraints on the model to prevent it. Now, you can still what's called jailbreak the model if you really press it. And there are, you know, Discord sites that provide all these jailbreak techniques. So if you really want to make the model do what it's kind of not supposed to or designed to do, then it's possible to do it. But the model developers over time continue to get better at preventing that. And, but I mean it, you know, I did a CFA event here in the summer using GPT-4, the model that was released in June, in the middle of June this year, and was able to go through the process of fully developing an investment policy statement. I did it live in front of about 100 CFAs and other people, interested parties. I just did it, worked through a case over about 40 minutes where I built out an entire investment policy statement, and it worked great. So it's not that the models are not able to do it. It's just that we haven't thoroughly tested their capacities. And OpenAI doesn't want to put people at risk by leaning on the models exclusively in domains that haven't been thoroughly tested and where they can't guarantee that it's going to give the right kind of results. Again, which I think we all probably agree is prudent.
On this idea of what it does well, I want to read you this quote I pulled off your Twitter because I think it was really good, and I think it gets at what a lot of people maybe miss about this. You said, "I've noticed an interesting phenomenon. Many narrowly focused experts reject AI because they evaluate it against their expertise in their narrow domain and find it wanting. This completely misses the point. For now, AI is not above the 90th percentile, i.e. expert level in most domains. The magic is that with naive prompting, it takes you to the 80th percentile in almost every domain. With better prompting, it takes you further. The real magic is that it makes everyone above average in every domain relative to where they were before AI." So can you just talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, there's actually been some really great studies on this. One of them was led by Boston Consulting Group in collaboration with a few Ivy League schools. I think one was Wharton, another was MIT. I think they took about just shy of 700 consultants, and they randomly divided them into three groups. One group wasn't given access to GPT-4. Another group was given access, but they weren't given any training. And the third group was given access, and they were given sort of cursory training, very light training, maybe an hour, on how to correctly prompt GPT-4. And then they evaluated the difference in both the quality and the efficiency of the work product between these different groups. And this was actually a very thorough analysis, and it's worth reading the paper. But a few interesting things were that it did improve the efficiency across the board for everybody, but it wasn't sort of a miraculous improvement. Now, you know, they evaluated this over a few weeks, and I do think that people get dramatically better at this as they use it, and the productivity gains are, you know, they do scale with use. The other thing is that if you if you integrate code with the models, your ability to scale just explodes higher. But anyways, you do get a productivity boost just in general from using the chat interface with GPT-4. But the most remarkable finding was that they also assigned the consultants into one of five groups based on just their quarterly reviews. So they do quarterly reviews with consultants, and they're grouped into sort of, you know, quintile one, quintile two, or whatever, quintile five, right? Where quintile five is our top consultants, quintile one needs improvement, right? And so they were also able to evaluate the quality of the work. And when they looked at the quality of the work, by the way, this were all evaluated by double blind evaluators. So they didn't know what group the consultants were assigned to, and they didn't know what quintile they had come from, right? But when they got the evaluations, what they found was that those in the bottom quintile before using ChatGPT had about a 40% lower quality evaluation than the top quintile. After using GPT-4, it went up to exactly the same. So the lowest quintile consultants were able to deliver exactly the same quality of work as the fifth quintile, the top quintile consultants, when everybody was given the ability to use GPT-4, right? So that's just one example. There's actually several studies that have come out that all get at a kind of exactly the same thing, which is, you know, the top, and the top quintile, they saw about a 12% increase in the quality of the work. The bottom quintile saw about a 40% increase in the quality of the work, right? So it did increase the quality of the work of the top quintile consultants, but the real boost was it made everybody above average. All of a sudden, you know, every consultant at BCG lives at Lake Wobegon, right? All of a sudden, everybody is now above average, and we've seen that replicated across a wide variety of domains.
I think about that in terms of investing. Like, let's say we've got a hedge fund that's got a bunch of analysts. Like, what you said is interesting to me, because on one hand, like, the lower level analysts might get a lot better, but on the other hand, the result of this could be, you said that the top people don't see as much of an improvement, but if this makes the elite analysts really, really good, like, does that mean we just get rid of the lower level analysts and, you know, we focus on the elite analysts and enhancing them with this? So how do you think about that?
I think we're going to need a lot fewer white collar knowledge workers. And, you know, I think professions that are especially vulnerable include, lawyers, maybe not litigators, but contract lawyers or paralegals, you know, people that are kind of doing a lot of the research and organization and writing the drafts of legal documents. I think, yeah, we're going to need a lot fewer investment analysts. You know, I can build a research assistant that can parse 10Qs or any other financial, you know, public financial document and extract exactly the level of information and knowledge and analysis and inference from those documents as a mid-level analyst can. I think general practitioners or family doctors will be working with these kinds of models very soon. And let's say working with, because, you know, so much of what it is to provide healthcare is in that personal relationship with the patient. Now, that said, there's billions of people that don't have access to high quality healthcare. And if given the choice between, you know, having to interface with a computer who gives you high quality diagnostic and prognostic and prescriptive results, or not seeing a qualified professional at all, then I think a lot of people are going to choose to use the machine, right? So, you know, across every knowledge domain that you could think of, this is going to have radical implications. And, you know, I just think I can't conceive of a world where we need all of the knowledge workers or even a fraction of all of the knowledge workers that are currently employed today. And if I could just sort of extend that a little bit, because you know, I was waiting anxiously to see how Microsoft, who partnered with OpenAI on and you know provided them with access to Azure cloud resources for a lot of their training and deployments of their models. And I was waiting to see how they decided to build this into Office and into you know, just the Microsoft operating system. And I was kind of not surprised to see that they decided to make it more of a co-pilot rather than deploying technology that actually completely replaces the role of these analysts, right? Think about the Microsoft revenue model, right? They earn their revenues based on the number of bums in seats. Everyone pays for a license for Microsoft Windows, and they pay another license for Microsoft Office and, you know, for Outlook, Mail, Exchange Server, all that kind of stuff, right? Well, if you need far fewer employees, obviously that's a massive hit to revenues. So instead, what they did was they just injected enough of the technology to empower employees, make their lives a little bit easier without deploying what the true potential would be, which is if I've got a history of all of these worksheets, and you know, and I've seen the workflow of an employee and how they take the documents from emails and use what's in those documents to populate the worksheets or whatever, this is all easily replicable by the AI without any human interaction whatsoever. You know, the AI can categorize expenses. Yep, an email comes in with an invoice. It can categorize the expense. It can look at the invoice. It can catalog the invoice where it needs to be cataloged. It can add the value of the invoice to the right section of the general ledger and update the GL. And, you know, like all of these downstream tasks can all be done by the AI without any human interaction. Just as the most narrow possible example of, you know, the true capacities of these new machines, right? And we're only scratching the surface with how we're embedding them in everybody's workday and everyone's life.
Yeah, on this issue of knowledge workers, it's interesting to me. Like when this first came out, you know, the general consensus was this is the first place this is going to hit is like something like truck drivers. And it turns out it's actually the opposite of that. Like the truck drivers are pretty safe because figuring that out's been really complicated. But the knowledge workers, you know, this is a major issue. So it's interesting how that flipped.
So much of knowledge work is taking unstructured data and turning it into structured data, right? It's like getting an email, updating a spreadsheet, getting an email, updating a database, getting an email, using that email to coordinate with somebody else to create a calendar event, having a meeting so that everybody can kind of give their unstructured feedback and someone can take notes. And then turn those notes into a task list or for project management. All of those things can be fully automated. It's one of the things that these new language models are so good at is taking unstructured data and turning it into structured data. It's also, I mean, it's obviously good at writing completely new and novel things, but it's also fantastic at taking, you know, the transcript from a meeting and turning it into a set of emails, a to-do list for all of the parties involved and, you know, coordinate with other parties outside of the organization to accomplish these tasks, right? Use the web browser to fill out forms and you know, book events at venues or book travel arrangements. All of these things can now be completely done from a single transcript by a series of agents powered by these language models.
I've been struggling with this. I mean, we don't get into trying to predict the stock market or anything, but you know, I've been the guy who says, you know, inflation's, you know, an issue here, valuations are really high. Like, I've kind of been like the negative guy in the stock market, but then I think back to like 1995 with the internet. And I think with this technology, and I think about, am I missing something? Like, is there some massive boom coming that's going to be deflationary? Is there some massive boom coming that's going to really impact all these companies in a way I can't even imagine? I mean, do you think through that at all? Like, when you think about the market as a whole?
I do, but I don't have a huge amount of confidence in how it's going to affect the stock market. My general intuition is, number one, this is where I think I have the highest confidence. This tech, because of the way it's been deployed and because of the legal decisions that have come down the pipe so far, I think this is the start of a Cambrian explosion of new entrepreneurship. Because, you know, what this has done, it has pushed the most capable technology to the edges of the network where anyone can access it. So, you know, if you can write in plain language how to perform a task, you can use those plain language instructions along with a set of tools that AI makes, that OpenAI, for example, makes available. It's not just OpenAI. There's a few other fantastic models out there. But, you know, you can use those tools with simple instructions to create your own chatbot with a very specific purpose and knowledge of that you have codified within that chatbot in order to accomplish a whole new set of tasks. You don't need to know how to code. You don't need to how to build a user interface in a backend database. You know, none of that stuff. You can accomplish all of that with plain language, and OpenAI will pay you based on the number of people that use your, or the amount of that your chatbot is utilized. Because when your chatbot is utilized, it's using OpenAI's language models, and they're charging based on the usage of the language models, right? They're charging a per token amount. And so that's beneficial to them. And you can get paid. I follow several people who are now making several thousand dollars a month from custom chatbots that they've just built on top of the OpenAI platform with OpenAI tech. And all they've done is, you know, write out customized long prompts that are very good at delivering a specific task. Well, that's just one narrow thing. When you combine these models with a little bit of code, keep in mind, these models can write the code for you, right? Then, you know, you can only imagine the number of potential use cases, because what you have is an intelligent agent that's able to make use of any exposed piece of code that does any task that you can possibly imagine, right? It can run back tests. It can get data to a database or store data in a database. The data that it pulls from a database, it can transform, consolidate, analyze, turn it into a report, populate a dashboard. Like, you name it, it can do it with just a little bit of code that the AI itself can help you write. You know, so I think the number of use cases for this is absolutely explosive, and I think it's going to have a major, major impact on entrepreneurship. What that does to these megalith tech corporations, I honestly don't know. You know, there are open source models that are almost as good as GPT-4. You know, the new Mistral Medium model, the documentation and the evaluation so far suggested it's effectively on par with GPT-4. It's a quasi open source model, which means they haven't given away how to fully build the model. But you can use any data set you want to fine tune the model. and you can host the model on any cloud server or a cloud service that you want. So, you know, you can use this tech to build a model that is specifically fine-tuned for your specific purpose, host it on a private cloud instance. So all of the data is completely private and you don't need to worry about any sort of data leakage or privacy issues. And use this model for whatever internal purposes you want. And the, you know, OpenAI gets nothing on this. Mistral, even the developer of the model, doesn't have a clear revenue model. I think their revenue model is probably, we can deploy custom instances of this for you if you want, but then so can anyone else, right? So the only group that benefits from this are the cloud compute providers, right? So to the extent that all of these applications require cloud compute, then, you know, that I can see as there's a moat. But also there have been new papers that even papers that I've seen over the last week that improve the efficiency of GPT-4 level models by on the order of 11. I saw one paper that was 11 times and another paper that was 50 times. I don't even know if maybe the 11 times and the 50 times compound. And maybe we're looking at 500 times in terms of efficiency. I know that I can now run a GPT-3.5, so like the original ChatGPT type model in terms of its capability, locally on my phone. So, you know, the efficiency of these models is also accelerating at an astonishing pace. So it's just really hard to know just how much compute we're going to need in order to get access to GPT-4 level models. And, you know, there's so much you can do with just GPT-4 level. We don't even need to think about GPT-5 and GPT-6 level models. Like, I think they're coming and I think we're going to see the same level of capability leap as we saw between GPT-3.5 or like original ChatGPT and GPT-4. But we don't even need to get that at all. Just GPT-4 alone is completely transformative for all knowledge work. So, you know, I think that part's really exciting. How it impacts stock markets, I think it may allow for major efficiencies across the board for most companies, but it's going to take a really long while to scale. Like, you've got to train people on how to make use of these models as well. We've got to build out all the legal infrastructure to allow big enterprises to use these and, you know, deal with privacy issues and all of the major enterprise issues that these large companies need to deal with. So where I really think it has the biggest potential is in the beginning, the very smallest companies. And over time, I think we'll see the very largest companies also begin to take advantage and get major scale issues from it.
Yeah, on the idea of small companies, I was listening to a podcast the other day where someone was talking about the idea that we're going to start seeing like billion-dollar companies that have five or less employees. Like that's something this technology is going to enable, which I don't think we've seen anything like that before. So it's just interesting, like small teams may be able to do like ridiculous things with something like this.
Yeah, I do wonder about that. I see the potential for just a gargantuan number of smaller companies. I do wonder where the 500 million, billion, you know, I don't know, because so much of the technology can be replicated relatively easy. Like, I do wonder about the moats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. The point I think that I sort of you made me kind of think about is, you know, we tend to, when we think about these innovations in our lifetime, and not in our lifetime, but when we think of, like, I kind of tend to think of like the internet, you know, internet development and what happened starting around the mid-90s. And still today, obviously, there's a lot of innovation around the internet. But, you know, the early days of that innovation cycle, you know, like building websites was like a heavy lift, right? It was like there was tons of code and it was new technology and you needed servers here and blah, blah, blah. Like, your point about, you know, this technology, it's it it's just, it can almost like create its own agents if you know how to prompt it and get it there. So the lift is, you know, not nearly as heavy. It just seems like it's going to speed up maybe the innovation cycle. And also, to your point, it brings it down to the individual level. Whereas before, in the last big, you know, internet, if you want to use that as an example, you know, you needed massive teams to do it. And so it's like, those are very interesting things to think about, and how, kind of from an investor standpoint, like, how do you, is there an opportunity there, and where that opportunity actually lives? I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I mean, I do. And I, you know, again, I think the bigger opportunity is at the very small enterprise level, because at the small enterprise level, you don't need to worry about all the scaling issues that you need to worry about for all the privacy issues, all the legal and branding, and you've got all these different people's information. And, you know, like, these are hard problems that have, you know, we need policy around them in order to make progress on it, right? But when you're at the very edge of the network as a small or medium, you know, independent business, you can innovate so quickly with, you know, very, very small risk. And I think you can also make use of the AI tools that allow for this kind of independent recursive innovation, where you're leaning on AI itself to tell you how to build the tools that are going to make best use of the AI, right? And there's this recursive innovation cycle that I think is just unbelievably powerful. I mean, I've seen it personally for a number of different projects, and I've seen like other teams make effective use of this for the projects that they're all working on. And, you know, I think it's going to be completely game changing, but just to overcome all the issues for large enterprises, it's just a different kind of problem.
Mm-hmm. Let's pivot to the investing side for the last half, just to kind of talk through some of the implications here. And I mean, maybe to start out, how are you guys using it at Resolve? Have you figured out ways to sort of start incorporating this into your investing process, or where are you guys with it, how you invest and how you think about investing?
I mean, we are using it at the system development level yet. I have used it for prototyping purposes. So for example, it is now trivial to take an article, like an academic paper, and turn that into a document that is easily readable by the machine, including all of the equations and tables, et cetera, and then iteratively work with GPT-4 to replicate the results in the paper, right? Now, I say trivial, you still need, you know, some basic skills in Python or R. You still need to know where to get the data that you need in order to do the replication. Like, there's still, like, the average person, I think, still is not able to get there easily. Although, like, you know, the average person can get futures data. They can get access to historical equity data through stuff like Portfolio 123 or, you know, some of the publicly accessible databases. Just it's a bit more expensive, and you do have to know a little bit of programming in order to make effective use of it. You know, it can't program Portfolio 123 for you yet, right? But I think if I owned Portfolio 123, what an amazing way to increase the number of, like, the size of your available market by integrating GPT-4 into your interface, so you no longer need to learn the whole Portfolio 123 portfolio building language. That it said, you can just create portfolio logic and run backtests using plain language, where GPT-4 will translate your intention to the language that's required to build these backtests, run them and evaluate them for you in whatever in whatever way you want, right? So it's coming. And I think, you know, replicating papers as prototype is fantastic, because so much for a quant anyways is a new paper gets published. Well, you know, what's going on exactly under the hood? They showed some fantastic results. Let's dig in. Can we replicate it on an investment universe that's actually tradable, or that we can use with our back-end trading infrastructure? Or, you know, this they attempted this on equities. Does this work in futures? Right? Whatever. I'm sure you guys have gone through this exercise a bunch of times. So now, instead of having to engage my full research team, I can use a tool called Marker to scrape the PDF effectively, so that it extracts all the tables and all the code and all the equations, et cetera, translates that into a Python program, iterates, doesn't all work in one go, not even close, iterate, right? Debug. And then see if you can replicate the results in the table. If you can, great. Now you can test it on other universes, or you can tweak it a little bit, or, you know, you can test it for robustness in a variety of ways. So that's a massive accelerant to the prototyping process that goes into the research pipeline. So now I don't need to, you know, bother an analyst who knows Python and knows how to translate those equations into code and build all the infrastructure on their own to be able to do that. You know, I can hire junior people to do that, because the initial stage of this is, can I replicate what's in the tables? Right? If I know I can replicate what's in the tables, then I know that this initial pass is correct. And now I can then take it on to the next stage, load in different data, test that, do a few other things. And you can do all this with plain language, right? You've got code now. Okay, I want to change this code to import this data from over here and rebalance at this frequency. And instead of holding it equal weight, hold it using equal risk contribution and whatever, right? Like, you can do all this with plain language. So, you know, I do think it's empowering, and it's an accelerant to the research process. We haven't used it for that. We've mostly used it for operational things at Resolve so far. But I, you know, one problem for a quant firm, probably for lots of firms, is how do you translate what's going on in the actual back-end trading process to things that the sales team and the marketing team can read, so they can answer questions, technical questions from potential clients or clients. They can write articles, et cetera, right? So exposing some of this back-end data, a lot of it's in like JSON format or CSV files. Maybe the CSV, I'm not referring to CSV files that contain, you know, long-term time series files, but JSON files or CSV files that just contain tables, mappings of symbols, or configuration files for different strategies or different sleeves of strategies, et cetera, right? And a client comes in and has a specific question. You know, how often is this rebalanced, this particular mandate rebalanced? Well, maybe the sales team doesn't know, and they don't have direct access to the JSON config file, but the language model has access to a list of JSON config files. Each of them are labeled as a tool that the language model has access to. And so it knows, oh, you want the config file for the carry strategy of the adaptive asset allocation fund. Yeah, okay, I know where how to call the tool that will bring that JSON file in for me to give you the answer, right? That's a really nice tool to have, and, you know, something that I think would be really useful to the sales team, right? So I'm just kidding. We could brainstorm for an hour, and I could literally give you, you know, an endless variety of these different kinds of use cases for how it is useful within an investment organization, even if you're not using it to write and manage production code at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of see like a spectrum, right? You have kind of the strategy, like, I guess, you know, the understanding of what, like your example of the academic papers and feeding that and then testing strategies, sort of trying to replicate it using data. And then you have sort of like the middle of building an investment strategy, how many stocks, what the rebalancing frequency is, what asset classes you're using. And then all the way over here, which you have just the AI building a strategy on its own, possibly in the future. The one problem I kind of see with that though is if you have, and whatever the prompt is, give me the best investment strategy you can build. You know, it's just, it seems to me like it's a big back testing episode, and that there would be risk to the technology just coming up with some optimal strategy that is more just random than built on sound economic like principles. But I don't know. So it's just a spectrum of development that I can see a firm using over time, starting from what you gave the example of all the way to maybe having the AI do it. Although I do think that people are always going to have to be able to explain what is going on. Well, maybe not always, but what is going on with the strategy? Why does it work? What the foundation of it is?
First of all, this is more of a thought experiment. And at the moment, we don't have policy or liability guidelines or anything like that that would allow for a registered advisor or money manager to use an AI to go and build a strategy and then deploy it and run it, right? And I'm not advising that, and absolutely that's not where I'm going. But as a thought exercise, I think it's worth exploring because, you know, implicitly in the framework you set up, you're assuming that the language model doesn't understand good testing practices, right? That it doesn't know ideas like holdout, for example, or survivorship bias or look ahead bias or the best practices of data science. And, you know, maybe it would actually know that you should be designing strategies using cross validation for hyperparameter optimization. You should be optimizing your hyperparameters on, and then have a validation set, and then have a holdout set. It should adjust for multiple testing, multiple hypothesis, you know, like it knows all of this too, right? So if you were to just sort of say, what are best practices for backtesting in finance using best practices in data science, it will give you a high quality technical specification for what that looks like. And then you can say, great, I have this idea, you know, build an application that lets me test this, assuming I have this data in this format over here, right? And it will go and it'll do that. And it'll use those best practices in order to develop it. Now, you know, I would argue lots of experienced quants do a lot of really not so good backtesting and don't necessarily have a great grasp of some of the nuances of the decisions that are made in the quantitative development process. It, you know, even reasonable prompts, you'd get a very thoughtful design from GPT-4 that would probably be on par or maybe even more thoughtful than what you get from kind of an average quantitative analyst. So, you know, just a different kind of way to think about it.
Yeah, well, that's a very good point. I want just to go back on something that I said. You know, if you prompted the technology to give you that and develop the strategy, then you could certainly ask it, well, what are the characteristics of the holdings over time? And to, you know, so I got to walk back my point about, you know, you're not going to be able to explain it because you would have the underlying data and the technology, you know, the output would tell you, well, it was buying these types of companies and this type of market regime, and these were your best performers. And, you know, just like you would, if you were showing anyone a back test and you had to talk to it, you could prompt it to get that information. So I kind of got to walk that back, I guess, a little bit.
Yeah, and it knows the schema of the CRISP database, right? Like it can tell you, here's how you merge these two tables in order mm-hmm. to get both the price data that you're looking for and the balance sheet or income statement data that you're looking for. Here's how to parse it and filter it and make sure you're only running it on large cap stocks above a certain cap threshold. It'll make suggestions. What are potential vulnerabilities of this approach that we have used to test this hypothesis? What are some other directions that I might explore that might be worthwhile? Collaborating with the machine is extremely effective and useful, and it comes up with really novel, useful ideas of how to extend your own exploration trajectory. So, I really think you need to think creatively about what these machines are able to do, because I have these conversations with people, and then I go through, well, actually, if you just take a step back and asked it, how might you approach this? It will give you a surprisingly good answer, and it'll help you execute it.
I'm just curious, like if I was thinking about someone I wanted to construct an investment strategy for me, like you were someone I would think of, and you probably have decades of experience learning all the things you need to know to construct an investment strategy, all the things that could go wrong, all the things you could do incorrectly in your testing. Like, are we going to get to a point where this technology becomes Adam, where like those decades of experience you have building strategies, like this will be able to do that?
I think not yet, but it's coming. Yeah. Absolutely. What's not coming is, or at least I think what's still quite a ways out on the horizon, is being able to use machines without having humans in the background to be blamed for when things go wrong, right? As anyone who's worked with machines for any length of time knows that it's often not the machines that are making an error. It's the human that has programmed the machines or has come up with the logic that the machines are going to repeatedly use in order to, execute tasks. There always has to be a human in the background to blame for when something goes wrong, right? And it will take a profound shift in policy and how we think about that balance of accountability and responsibility before we're able to eliminate humans from the picture altogether. But, in terms of general capability, you could also, what does a human do now? Well, could I build a lot of the infrastructure that I need in order to run kind of some of our strategies now using GPT-4 over time? Yeah, I would have to take an active role in supervising it. Over time, that role that I would have to take in supervising it, I think will get smaller and smaller, right? I still think in complex domains like this, there's complex domains in any kind of scientific method, and I hesitate to use empirical finance as a science, but maybe going towards sort of medical research, right? I think an AGI, a generalized intelligence that exceeds the intelligence of any human across all domains, may get to the point where they are able to come up with new ideas and new research directions, and for a time, instruct humans about how to do the tasks that are required in order to make technological progress, because maybe they're not able to go to the cabinet and get the right chemicals and compounds that are required to, to bring over. The robot can handle the beakers and stir things together and analyze the output from the mass spectrometer. But, a human's got to be in the mix to go do menial things, right? Which again is just like, you only need the most basic lab tech to be able to help the computer to make huge leaps forward, or the AI to make huge leaps forward in science. You don't need the actual knowledge worker at that point. I don't think we're there yet, but, you know, I can see a trajectory that gets us there in a timeline that I think is much shorter than most people realize.
On your point about the human to blame, I was thinking about self-driving cars because, you know, our standards for self-driving cars are going to be very, very different than our standards. You know, even if they're 100 times safer, that's not good enough because we're still going to highlight the errors. And it is probably the same thing in the financial business. Like if you screw up my financial life, even if the computer ends up being 100 times better than the person, I still want the person to blame sitting behind it.
Exactly. Yeah. That's algorithm aversion. And I mean, it's tragic, really, right? I mean, if we deployed only self-driving cars and we never allowed humans to drive, our death rates from automobile accidents would be cut by 80%. Like something just astonishing. It would be cut by like 80%. But we are so overly averse to accidents that are caused by machine error relative to human error, that, you know, we don't have any kind of framework to implement this kind of policy, right? And it's tragic from a human life standpoint. I also want to sort of make a point about, you know, could a human replace completely, or sorry, could an AI or a series of AI agents replace a full stack asset management company? To be fair, there is a lot. I would argue almost most of the value of an asset management company is all of the infrastructure, legal infrastructure, contracts, custodial relationships, you know, all of the bits and pieces that turn a strategy into an asset management business and a fund that runs that people can subscribe for units to, et cetera, right? Like there's an enormous amount of complexity there that I would argue that an AI will eventually, or a series of AIs will be able to handle. But again, that is a series, that's a coordination task across a wide variety of enterprises with a wide number of different failure points that will be, I think, quite a long time before we have a legal and policy framework that will accommodate machines managing and navigating all of those different dimensions.
What in your mind would you say is the number one thing investors should be thinking about with this technology? And I'll tell you what pops in my mind, and it sounds super ridiculous and just simple, but it's like, to me, it's like, I just think people, if they haven't used it, they should really engage the technology to see the real power. Cause that's the only, and you know, everyone will use it differently. Some people will use it to do creative stuff, write me a song about this or whatever. Others will use it in other, but you know, that's the only. So I think like when these new technologies come around, a lot of people tend to shy away from using them because they don't understand them or whatever. But you know, I'm just curious what you would say to just the average investor. What should they really be thinking about here with their portfolios and something like ChatGPT?
Yeah, I mean, I know this is an investment podcast, and I'm the CIO of a quantitative investment firm, and I mean, I really don't have a good answer to that. I think, if anything, life is going to change and business and the economy are going to change so quickly and in such fundamentally strange ways over the next decade and more that the uncertainty around what could happen is now vastly wider than it was over the next 10 years than it was before we saw the existence proof of the level of AI that we see with GPT-4. And so I think that perhaps you need to give a little bit more respect to the kinds of investment strategies that lean a little bit less heavily on what happened in the past to inform what might happen going forward. I've never been a big fan of cap-weighted investing, but a nice compromise for cap-weighted investing is equal weighting large cap stocks, right? An equal weighted holding of the S&P 500, right? Even an equal weighted holding of the S&P 1500, that kind of thing, I think is a really nice way to hedge it. Because again, I really feel like so much of the innovation and profit capture is going to come at the edges of the network by entrepreneurs building small niche apps. And so I don't know how that affects these larger public companies. You know, we still need the compute for now. Who owns compute? Microsoft, Amazon, Google, right? So as long as we need compute and compute is scarce, I can see a reason why these might have premium valuations. So I wouldn't want to go entirely small cap. You know, I don't know. I don't know now more than I haven't not known at any other time in the past.
We could probably spend another hour just talking through a lot of this, but we do have to bring it to a close at some point. And maybe we will, try to have you back on, Adam, and discuss this. It's going to be fun, exciting to watch this all unfold. But I think to your point, it's also, there's a lot of uncertainty around this, and depending on how it's used and it might not always be used for good things either. So people have to be paying attention, I think, to that, as well. And some of the points that you made sort of made me realize, why some of these, people at places like OpenAI and other places like Microsoft are probably thinking about this more from a philosophical point of view around the impact that this is going to have for society in the future, because it's going to be pretty major. And, they're the ones making the decisions around sort of where the future might end up being to some extent.
Yeah. So, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think that this technology is going to be unbelievably disruptive in ways that society is just not well prepared for. And we're going to have to make some interesting choices over the next 5 or 10 years. I personally think these choices are decades overdue. And so, while it may be a trying time, I think ultimately we are going to end in a much better place than we are now in our hyper-financialized, over-indebted economic situation. And we're going to have to think very differently about the utility of a human, instead of thinking about them exclusively from the perspective of how much value that a human can add to the bottom line. When machines are able to add more value to the bottom line than any human, then obviously that becomes a very different kind of equation. And I'm excited for humanity to come to terms with that, because again, I feel like that's long overdue.
Thank you very much, Adam. We really appreciate it. Happy holidays to you and your family.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you.
This is Justin again. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Excess Returns. You can follow Jack on Twitter at @practicalquant and follow me on Twitter at @JJCarboneau. If you found this discussion interesting and valuable, please subscribe in either iTunes or on YouTube, or leave a review or a comment. We appreciate it.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.